kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 109, with me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Belshaw. Di, it's been about 3 weeks. What have you been up to?
Oh, I've been up to plenty. It has been 3 weeks, hasn't it? We've not been able to match our schedules at all. What have I been up to? I tell you what, I've done some awesome work in the last 24 hours, 48 hours.
If you do say so yourself.
If I do say so myself. Well, I don't know. Do you ever do a piece of work? I'm sure you do. You know when you get that sort of that tickle of excitement about something that you're doing?
Right.
And it's got, like, you know, it's a bit edgy and it's a bit kind of different and out there. And so what I did is we have
the kids into the forest, pick mushrooms and smoke them. No, what?
No, I didn't do that. All that would probably tickle me as well. So we have PSHE, and here it's called Learning for Life. We've changed its name and rebranded it. And the person who's running it asked me if I would do a video because it's delivered in the boarding houses to groups of 12 at a time. So they asked me if I do a video on phones, so with mobile phones here. So when our third form arrive in September, they are the sort of big year group. We have younger children than that, but they're only in little year groups. And they don't have their phones the first 3 weeks to sort of, so they can't contact home except via email. And from this point forwards, then they go home for a weekend. Now they're back and they get their phones every night for about 20 minutes. And until half term, and then they get them more after that. So anyway, we're doing a video about phones and looking at all of the things. So I made this video, and it was called Phones: The Good, The Bad, and The Complicated. So I was just going to talk into a camera and talk about the things that I talk about phones, and that I think would be good for them, you know, to stimulate some discussion and that kind of thing. And then they would discuss in their groups what they thought about it. So because we had field weekend, which is so where all the junior pupils go home and then the senior pupils go away and do something, I was looking after my digital leaders for the weekend, as well as my boarding house and those that remained in it. So I just thought, well, I had to do this video because it was due for today. I thought, well, let's just get the digital leaders to do it rather than me do it, you know. So I'd had a sort of structure of a content to do. And then we were on a trip. I was taking them out on the Monday for lunch to eat chicken in a restaurant in Peterborough. We were on the bus, and so I just used my phone with the selfie camera on, started talking to myself, as it were, and then held the phone above my head to where they were sitting around me on the top deck of the bus. It just had a real, really good feel about it. And we just talked about, you know, different things. So it was what was good about phones, what was bad about them, and what you needed to watch out for, really. It just had a really good vibe to it. Anyway, along comes D-Day, and then in every boarding house, all of these teachers, so 16 different teachers and all 200 pupils will have watched my face in their face on their big TVs in the boarding houses. talking rubbish, and it was literally one take stuff, you know. So it was there were two sections. An introductory section was just me, and then the section on the bus, which was just all one take, you know. So so I did some editing with some captioning on it to sort of identify the key points that the pupils were saying. But it just felt kind of radical, for want of a better word. It was great.
Good, kind of freed from the constraints of.
It was something where, I really felt like it was kind of cutting through the boulder dash, you know?
Yeah.
Like not respecting anything that isn't really necessary, but and making the content important. And because I was just holding the phone, we were on a bus, it was a bit noisy, and it wasn't like going for really good, smooth, slick editing or anything like that. It was kind of hand to mouth or off the cuff or whatever you want to say.
And gritty in real life, yeah.
Yeah, sort of thing. And what the children said wasn't rehearsed. It was, so we talked about stuff beforehand, but it wasn't rehearsed. And they kind of said what they thought. That was cool. So they said good points about it and bad points about it. And it was cool. Good.
Okay.
Me like.
And you've been having some issues with your machine as well.
I upgraded. I upgraded because the computer asked me to. I upgraded from 16.04 to 18.04 LTS version of Ubuntu. And I thought it was all going to run smoothly because it asked me to, and then it stopped halfway through, something to do with the print cups or something. And then the machine was dead. So I had to completely wipe it and start again, which was really annoying. But it's all up and running beautifully now, actually. I'm really pleased. And then I found this video, which I've linked to in the show notes, of some 18.04 tweaks. Which are really good. So it's some software to install and how to customize, put dconf on and Synaptic and things like that. But just this guy who's very experienced with Ubuntu has just recommended all these tweaks that he does. So it's looking really smart. I'm really pleased with it at the moment.
I'm running Ubuntu 18.04 on my laptop. I'll check that out.
Yeah. No, it's nice. It has an index in the notes of the video, so it's worth you can just pick and choose because lots of it I'd done already, but some of it I hadn't seen before. It's great. However, having said that, the software that we use for this recording this podcast called Zoom, which you have an account for through Moodle, doesn't work on it. So it seems to load properly. But when I try to join the conversation, so right now I'm working on my Ubuntu computer, but I'm recording this into my MacBook, just sitting over on the sofa. There we go.
Oh, well, since we last spoke, I have been doing the following. I spoke at the ALT conference, the Association of Learning Technology. I did a presentation about MoodleNet and caught up with some people I haven't seen for a while because that's the kind of conference where I would go to when I was at JISC. I don't think I went to when I was at Mozilla, so it's been a few years since I've been. But caught up with some people who I haven't seen for quite a long time. That recording of the presentation is online, actually. I'll put the link in the show notes. There's 2 minutes of like sponsors advert, which you can skip. And then it looks like a very long video, but actually it was one of those sessions which is split into two. So it's about 20 minutes of me talking about MoodleNet, which I think went reasonably well.
Good.
So it was 2 weeks ago. Last week I was in London. So ALT was in Manchester. Last week I was in London for MoodleNet's front-end development workshop with Outlandish, the co-op who are doing the front-end development and design work for MoodleNet. That was good. Mael Dabornial, who is our technical architect, he flew in from Athens, and we spent 3 days in an Airbnb together and working with Kaylee, Sam, and Rob at Outlandish. Really enjoyed that. Then this week, we have added a new member to the MoodleNet team, so we've now got a back-end developer. His name's Alex, Alex Castano. He is based in Barcelona. And good guy. Just kind of getting to know how we work together as a team. It's always different when you add a new member to a small team. It changes the dynamic. So that's all good. And then today's Wednesday, which is the 26th of September. And tomorrow and Friday, I am due to be up a mountain in the Lake District as part of the ongoing number of days I have to do mountain days, quality mountain days to get onto the mountain leader course. As you can possibly hear from my voice, I'm on the edge of a bit of man flu. So I'm dosing myself up, drinking whiskey and generally trying to power through tomorrow and Friday because I've booked the time off and booked my accommodation. So is that? Oh, and there's one other thing as well I wanted to mention. So I'll not mention their name, but I know that they listen to this podcast and they wrote an email to me asking for some career advice. And it's one of those things, Di, where I think a lot of people have got similar questions. So I thought I'd write up as a blog post, and it's turned into a bit of an epic blog post, and I still haven't finished it. And it's currently 1,855 words. So
wow.
I'm looking forward to publishing that sometime soon.
You heard it here first. Mm-hmm. Dr. Doug's career advice. It's coming your way down the tubes. Cool. Well, that sounds like a busy time and you've had a good, positive time. New guy on the team.
Mael goes off on holiday actually next week. So there's a bit of crunch time and then he comes back just before the Mozilla Festival. And then I go to Denver for the Moodle Moot in the US. And then, you know, it's kind of 2 months before we launch MoodleNet. And yeah, it's one of those things.
Okay. Well, what else have I been doing then? I've been buying some like decal things for my classroom, cheap and cheerful.
Right.
So I didn't know really, and I was looking at them. There's not very many technology related things, and I could have made, I probably still will actually get my own made with some code in them, you know, just have like little programs around the room. but because the room hasn't got anything on it, I've got no marker boards on it in there either. So my room's a bit weird. There's computers all the way around the edge, and there's three 50-inch displays in the middle in a T shape, two back to back, one across perpendicular to that, and the children sit in a horseshoe on their computers. So there's not much wall space. There's quite a few windows. Three windows you look out of, you see greenery, which is beautiful. So I bought this Banksy one. You know, the little girl who with a red heart balloon floating.
Yeah,
away.
I saw you post on Macedon.
No, that's right, I did. And so I put that in the window, and I got a couple of others coming, which are like kittens tearing through wallpaper. I thought, what do you put in a computer room? Cats, obviously. Cute kittens. So there's three. I haven't put them up yet, but there's three pictures of kittens. And they're like tearing through the wall. Do you know what I mean? Emerging. So I'm doing that. And then I've got some spooky things. I just thought, this is such fun. the schools, I have to pay for it, but I have to work in the classroom every day. So I'm not bothered about that really.
I'm going to put the link into the show notes, because you've got the girl with a balloon. You've got the girl on one window and then the balloon kind of floating away on the other window, which looks it's really impressive, actually.
It looks really sweet, isn't it? I was quite pleased when I worked that out. She just fits inside the frame. So it's kind of cool.
So what are those from?
I just ordered them on Amazon. Nothing, nowhere exciting, I'm afraid. I just looked for what was easy to get. And we'll see what the other one's going to be like. I don't know. So some of them take longer to turn up because they're coming from further away. I'm really pleased with that. And so I've been teaching, and it's always fun starting coding with like GCSE classes and things like that, and you know, getting to know new classes and thinking, this is fabulous, and then thinking, he's odd, she's odd, or whatever, you know, getting to know their individual characteristics. So that's been quite enjoyable. With my lower six, I have one lesson per fortnight on a Saturday morning at 8:30 with them. I have more lessons than that, but just this, it's not every Saturday, it's just one every other Saturday. So that's normally when I would do my remote lessons that I've done before, like on Slack and whatever, and they would stay in there. You know, we can just stay in our respective places and just get out of the house a little later. And but I didn't do that in the first instance because it's the beginning of the year. And so I just thought, I'm going to do a lesson on, as I walked into the classroom, door handle planning, on personal professional learning networks, or whatever, personal learning networks, whatever you want to call them, PLNs. And so I started introducing it, and I started thinking about it, and I said, well, you don't really have a choice of whether you have a PLN or not. Everybody has a PLN. You have some kind of support structure in place for your learning. So everything, so I put this out on Twitter and Mastodon. So on Mastodon, I wrote, let me read it. I've linked to it in the notes, but it's easier to read it. Introduced the concept of a PLN to my new AVL class this morning. I presented it as something that you don't have a choice about. Everybody has one, be it your parents, teachers, classmates, the internet at large, social media services. It simply exists. The question is, are you aware of it, and can you influence or build it to serve your purposes? How might you do that? Mastodon, Twitter, newspapers, journals. Will be interesting to see how they respond. So this coming Saturday is the second lesson I will do on this with them, and see what they're thinking about it. But this guy replied to me, a doctor from somewhere. What's his name? Sorry, I'm having to go back down my notifications. Dr. Brian Balson Stanton, he's called. Mm-hmm. He said, can I talk to them through you about this? And he said, I expect none of this to be news to you, but to encourage a very strong preference for original sources. So news shouldn't be fetched from services paid to promote competing interests, Twitter, Facebook, etc. But as close to the source as possible. As a necessary component in this is an intentional pull interaction with content. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. So he goes on and talks about RSS and a little bit of this, that, and the other. So it'd be quite interesting to see what they make of that. So I put the same message out on Twitter, and I got a reply, which was pretty cool, really, because I got a reply from one of my former pupils. This former pupil is at university, I think at UCL, and he also works for Monzo at night and at the weekends. We've talked about him before, because he's the one that makes the back end for the Fifth Gear website, you know, the TV show Fifth Gear.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So he was making money when he was at school. So, you know, he's not surprised that he's gone and got a job with Monzo whilst he's at university. And it was interesting that he replied, because he had no idea what PLN was. We had a little bit of joking around about that. And then he said, well, yeah, no, PLN, like his use of Twitter has been absolutely instrumental to the work that he's got. So just getting to know people, he's quite a shy character in real life, but on social media, he has just reached out to people and you know, done the right thing. Like, he's liked their work and sort of said, thanks for sharing that and this, that and the other, and made connections with them, and then gone along to hackathons and gone along to events. And so he cited, what is it that he said?
Well, this is some of the advice that I'm giving in this thing that I'm writing for this person. Uh-huh. And actually this person, hello, you're listening to this podcast, I know, is already doing this, and it's exactly the right approach, but it's one of those things where it doesn't pay dividends straight away. It takes a while. Like, you have to, you reap what you sow, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just about behaving in a way that's going to amplify what other people are saying and do the other things. I'm just trying to find what he actually said, because it was kind of cool. But gosh, does this, No, that's, then somebody in my school talked to me, which was weird. Getting there. Looking back, it's one of the things that allowed me to get into tech, which is a big thing for him to say, considering he's had so much success, even when he was 16, financial success with what he was doing, his coding. He says, I just knew people, and when stuff was happening, which meant I went to stuff and met more people. Without it, I wouldn't be at Monzo. I wouldn't be organizing UK GovCamp, et cetera, et cetera. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And you know, the great thing about social media at its best is that it allows the kind of things that previously were only available to, you know, the kind of networking that you'd only really get at private schools. Because he's talking about social media networking as getting him the job beyond the kind of networks that he made at a private school like yours, Di. Mm-hmm. And I would say that I got my job as Director of e-learning because of Twitter mainly. It helped when I joined JISC. I actually saw them during the interview checking out my social media feeds when I was.
I think I got my job here on the back of my online profile, shall we say, whatever that might mean.
Well, it's the first thing you do. I mean, I've been hiring people recently, and like there was one person that like, well, the best one in the world. I could. It would be a risk. It would be a liability for me to hire them, because I wouldn't know what they were going to say about the project and like slag me off behind my back kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Anyway, so that was quite interesting. We'll see where that goes. I just thought it was an interesting thought about PLNs. Basically, is that they're actually not a choice. They're just there.
Someone replied. I don't know if they got us two mixed up or whatever, but somebody did ask me out of the blue, said, oh, I saw you tweeting about PLNs, and I wondered to what extent they're going to be a part of MoodleNet. And I thought, I haven't been tweeting about PLNs.
That's because one of the jokes, when my former pupil asked me, who's called Hugh, I can say his name, he's left, he's called Hugh Wells, left a couple of years ago. And so he didn't know what a PLN was. That was his reply. What is a PLN? He said. So then I said, and my response was, I can't remember now, something to do with a napkin, a pathological liar's napkin, I think.
Yeah.
And you just fade.
I have to say, I don't like the term. I find it a bit pretentious.
Well, no, but that's the thing, I do as well, but it's not my choice, basically.
But yeah, if you want to refer to it, it's a bit like referring to a MOOC. Like, it's just an annoying shorthand.
Exactly. So then my next response to him was, I said, I'm only joking. I didn't wait for a reply. And then it was just pick one of these. And in some kind of dictionary, acronym dictionary, there were 20 different definitions of PLN. I said, just choose one from this list. and he got it right, obviously. It's fun times.
I think there's something almost a bit sinister about, like, intentionally creating your PLN. Like, it seems a bit, I don't know.
Oh no, I think that's right, but I don't think, but there's nothing sinister about gathering resources around you and knowing where they are and using them. So I don't see a personal, so I had an interesting reply from somebody called Tanya on Mastodon. And she was talking about how inanimate objects can teach you as well. So she said, I've been thinking not only about the people who teach us, but the things. We talk about being self-taught, but really something, animate or inanimate, has done the teaching. And I replied some daft nonsense to that, as I do. I said, true enough. I said, there's always something behind the learning. The tech, I suppose, simply provides many more methods for us to access this in a convenient or preferred way. But can a thing teach? As I walked, I sat there, and I just made this bit up, obviously. As I walked, I sat by a tree and engaged my senses to learn as much as I could. Did the tree teach me? And she says, yes.
Well, this is the relationship between teaching and learning, isn't it? Just because you taught doesn't mean someone learned. And just because no teaching was taking place doesn't mean that someone didn't learn. Like, things can be a stimulus for realization and learning.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting idea, isn't it, that everything has got something to teach. I mean, when you look at the world, I always think this, so when you look at a building, I always wonder what that building has to teach me. And it has certain things about construction and engineering to teach me, and materials, like the materials it's been made of and things like that, and things to learn and to feel and to touch. But it also has the life, the actual journey that it went upon. You know, who commissioned that building, who designed that building, who actually built that building, where did they go home for tea, and things. I always think like that, you know.
And some of that is like almost childlike thinking, like seeing the world as a place of wonder and joy, and just applying that to people. You know, there's almost like these homely kind of quotations about, you know, everybody that you meet on life's journey has something to teach you. Mm. And I think sometimes we're so bound up with status that we think that someone who is lower than us in society doesn't have anything to teach us. But of course, that's bollocks, because everyone has an interest, a specialism, whatever.
No, yeah, because I always think that they do. I always think they have. I'm always interested in people's lives. Whenever I see sort of grand buildings, and in my travels, I see quite a lot. And in my school, I see quite a lot of them, I guess. And I'm always more interested in who built them, as in the people whose hands built them, than I am about the people who came up with the idea, like cathedrals and things like that, you know? Anyway, move along.
A day in hippie education.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Right, okay, we've gone there. You're up the mountains. Career advice.
Well, let's go to the other extreme. So we've been talking about trees and flowers and learning from nature and other people. Let's go to the other extreme about, like, China and citizen surveillance.
Yeah, this is a phenomenal article from the Australian broadcasting company, ABC. Really interesting website, and of like sort of these little snippets of video with text. As you scroll, you get more text, and they're more actually suited to a touch screen, to like a phone, really. Present exactly the same on the phone as they do on a computer. And it's just going through this person who called Dan Dan. I don't know if that's her real name, could be. And so she's a professional person, and it's just mocking up how the face recognition system works, so that there are so many surveillance cameras in China now that they're just tracking people wherever they go, and they're just constantly tracked, and they're developing this massive system of social credit that we've discussed before, but they're amplifying it onto a greater scale. So this article takes you through exactly what it is that they're doing, and it will be. It says the Communist Party calls it social credit, and says it will be fully operational by 2020. It will allow.
I've got two monitors side by side, and one of my monitors I have rotated portrait, so it's a bit like a phone layout. Anyway, so I've got this full screen on my phone, and going down and having the little bits of video is amazing. The bit that just caught my eye was Dan Dan in the supermarket, where it says, buying too much alcohol might suggest dependence. She'll lose a couple of social credit points.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to work out if Dan Dan's real. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, so what they're thinking is, so the Communist Party outline claims, I quote, allow the quoting them, this is not the article, allow the trustworthy to roam freely under heaven while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step, is what they're saying. So it's going to be a personal scorecard for each of China's 1.4 billion people. The pilot program, which we've talked about before, I think, already in place. Each citizen is assigned a score of 8 out of 800. In other programs, it's 900. And you get top citizen scores, you get VIP treatment at hotels and airports, cheap loans, fast track to the best universities and jobs. So you don't have a choice, basically.
Yeah, and then further down, it's got Lee Hu, an investigative journalist who lost all of his social credit because the government considers him an enemy, and he was charged with speech crime, so he's locked out of society due to his low social credit score. It's destroyed his career and isolated him. He now fears for his family's future.
Yeah, again, so I'm assuming that these people are real. I mean, they do look real, don't they? The way that it's put. I'm not sure the mock-ups of the software is real whilst they're walking around the city and stuff. But obviously, this has lots and lots of scary, scary things and potentials. And that investigative journalist is one. But it's people making mistakes and things just going dreadfully, dreadfully wrong.
Well, I'm gonna bring in here a book that I've read in the time since we last spoke, which is John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And Di, if I hadn't already passed it on to Mael, because I finished it when I was in London, I'd send it through to you. It's an amazing book, extremely well written, and like very illustrative in terms of the investigation he goes through and the conclusions that he reaches as well. And there's this particular bit towards the end where he says, quote, "We see ourselves as non-conformist, but I think all of this, online shaming, is creating a more conformist conservative age. We are defining the boundaries of normality by tearing apart the people outside of it," end of quote. And okay, China's doing some scary tech-enabled social credit system, but certainly my experience of social media over the last few years has been that it's almost having like a chilling effect or cooling effect on bringing your full self online, because you're seen as, you know, that people are, this outrage culture is, people are always ready to jump on you and say that you've done something wrong.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair shout. It's quite difficult. I hadn't seen this before. There's actually a YouTube link, which I've just turned on. I'll wait till I can skip the video and see how long it is. Looks like it's only... I'll watch it later. But that's an interesting... There is no good side to this, basically, no. I don't think. And I understand what they're trying to do, and you understand why they're coming to this logical conclusion about making people conform to what they consider to be the norms that allow society to operate. And I imagine that some of the challenges that China faces are not experienced in this country, although we are quite crowded, I guess, in comparison to many countries.
The problem comes when, like, you know, the whole quotation, I can't remember exactly what it is, but about all it takes is for a few good people to do nothing. Like, if you're comfortably middle class and you know that there's plenty of people who are worse off than you, and they bring in something like a social credit score, and actually you don't do too badly out of it, maybe you don't complain. Maybe you don't put your head above the parapet, because actually if you did, that would make your position worse off. And yeah, okay, it might make society as a whole worse off, but as long as you and your family's okay, then maybe that's okay. That's the logic, which is maybe never articulated like that, but certainly might happen, I think, in that kind of
situation. But I think, I mean, and that's it. And you can imagine if this was coming to our country, that it would be caged in all sorts of fearful language, just like Brexit was, you know. You just get all of these scare stories going on, and people would believe them, and they do. There would be massive headlines, and that would scare people, and they would think, "Well, I don't do anything wrong. This is fine by me," you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, well, interestingly related to that, I've got another article up which I haven't linked to, but it's did you see this? It's called "The GCHQ Data Collection Regime Violated Human Rights: A Court Rules," and this is a Guardian article.
Okay.
So, and it's talking about the bulk interception of online communications that GCHQ have done, have violated privacy and failed to provide sufficient surveillance safeguards. And that's the European Court of Human Rights ruling, which is kind of a big deal. So this is an article from not long ago. I'm looking for the date, 13th of September. But it shows that... So Snowden actually quotes this article, Edward Snowden does, on Twitter, and he says, "For 5 long years, governments have denied that global mass surveillance violates your rights. And for 5 long years, we have chased them through the doors of every court. Today we won. Don't thank me. Thank all of those who never stop fighting. And then it links to this article. So that's, you know, it's not a small thing, you'd have to say. And it is sort of on the back of GDPR, which has been holding the major tech corps to account, as we discussed before. And on the back, you know, there is the regulation, the legislation, sorry, is catching up. And it's just getting a bit better. Whether it's too late or not is another question, but it'll be interesting to see where this goes now, whether it actually comes back to inform any amendments to the policies like REPA and such like.
There's an article I wasn't sure, like, I haven't read it in lots of detail yet because it's quite a long one, and it's on the New York Review of Books. And actually the person who shared it on Mastodon, you know, said that they weren't sure whether to share it or not, because they said, I was somewhat hesitant to share this at first because I'm suspicious of any attempt to call Snowden's motivations into question. I even had to read it and a couple of other articles that were linked to by this particular person thoroughly before following them back or even allowing them to follow me. After thinking about this a lot, I've realized that the article raises very important issues, which is that equivocating between the US and Putin is bad for justice in the world. So this particular article is talking about, like, it's just trying to think about what Edward Snowden's actual motives and reasons were, and the ideology of Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, and to what extent they got legitimacy through The Guardian sending a senior journalist along.
Oh, okay. So,
and the fact that Edward Snowden ended up in Russia, and, you know, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and all that kind of stuff. So it's something I need to dive into a bit more, but we're living in an age where it's very difficult to know what's actually going on, which takes me actually to an article that was shared by Amy Berval on our Slack channel. Basically, somebody talking about how we're teaching history incorrectly. It was an article in Slate, which I linked to in my thought chapel. And the reason they say that we're teaching history incorrectly is because we're not teaching the kind of, like, web literacy in terms of online news stories, this kind of stuff, that you need to know to be able to do history properly. Just a quick quotation from that, and I do link to Mike Caulfield's Web Literacy for Student Fact Checkers, which is a book that you might be interested in, Di. The quote from this Slate article is, fact checkers know that in a digital medium, the web is a web. It's not just a metaphor. You understand a particular node by its relationship in a web. So the smartest thing to do is consult the web to understand any particular node. That is very different from reading Thucydides, where you look at internal criticism and consistency, because there really isn't a documentary record beyond Thucydides. Oh, I wish that was an easier to pronounce name. End of quote. So what he's saying is that we teach in history class, we teach about kind of internal logic of stuff and checking the veracity of the author. But really on the web, it's a completely different thing. It's not like doubling down on checking this person's passport details or LinkedIn profile. It's much more kind of the web, like it's doing some kind of triangulation, a bit like when I've been hiring people, looking at lots of different sources and trying to come to some type of decision as to whether to invite them to interview.
Yeah. I was just looking at these. I'm not good on history, I have to say. But I think it's interesting how, like, in so I'm familiar with A-level history because my children did it. I remember trying to help out a bit and proofread source essays, that, you know, you're given three sources, and to do it really well, which they all did, they all got A stars or A's at A level in them. To do it really well, they were just crazy things. Source A does this to source B, does this to source C does this to source A, and this means this, and that means this. And it was just like, wow, okay, really? Is that what we're really talking about? What kind of essay is that? Does anyone read that? Does anyone read like that?
No, it's outdated. I mean, it is very good in terms of, like, critical analysis of stuff, and it's a bit like teaching some things in maths that you'll never actually do in practice. It's a similar kind of thing, just like critical thinking and whatever. But I guess this article is saying that that's not enough. And this is where history, which I always taught with lots of technology, this is where history meets ICT and computer science.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I remember because and in every private school I've ever worked in, when I've met the historians on staff, they're all, there are some of them, not all of them by any means, but there's always a couple who are quite egocentric about their subject and their discipline and things like that. And so I always mock them by saying history is nothing but the documentation of advancement of technology across the ages and who used it best. that just winds them, up, really. But I think that's interesting. I've talked to Amy before about how she teaches history, and she would always pull common threads from historical events together across the ages, and she would teach it in that way. So she'd look at different wars and how they connect in different places in the world and at different times and how they connect together and things like that, which I always thought was really interesting, a way of doing it. What was I going to say about history and technology? I had something in my head. It's gone. Okay.
All right, well, we've just been talking about kind of social media and things, and I thought it was really interesting that Twitter posted a photo of an early sketch. I think it was like, you know, they launched Twitter in 2006, at the end of 2006. I joined in early 2007. I think you joined about the same time. Mm-hmm. And this was a photo of an early sketch that Jack Dorsey, one of the Twitter founders, had made for the kind of early user interface, and I've linked to that in the first line of this post. And the interesting, and it's mentioned in this Fast Company article. And the interesting thing is just on a legal pad like they have in America. And one of the things, or a couple of things they have on Jack Dorsey's put on this, which just shows what it was like 13 years ago, different world. One of the things was you could indicate on the interface for Twitter that you were in bed or going to the park or reading a book, yeah, and that you might not, you know, reply for a while.
Oh, right, that you'd have some time out. Yeah. It's also interesting, it's the link on the right hand side. It says email looks for Jabber presence and sets. So Jabber is a plugin to Outlook as well as other things, so it's connecting up to your longer communications tool, I guess. That's okay, but you've written quite a lot about this. So what is there to...
Yeah, so it's because like the next day after they tweet this this article about like, oh, hey, 13 years ago, blah, 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 the New Yorker kind of had this really stark image and caption for at the top of this article. And the caption for the header image was, social media platforms know what you're seeing and they know how you acted in the immediate aftermath of seeing it, and they can decide on what you're going to see next. Which, of course, is completely different to how Twitter first was. You could interact via text. It was a chronological feed, which I think they're reintroducing.
Oh, are they really?
As far as I'm aware. So, you know, if you put it that way, they know what you're seeing. They know how you acted in the aftermath of seeing it. Did you retweet it? Did you favorite it? Did you kind of ignore it? What did you do next? And then they can decide what you see next. So it's a quite a interesting, you know, when you put it that way. And I think that we in the West look at things like China, which is quasi-totalitarian, and think, well, you know, we're a bit different over here, aren't we? But actually, there's a quote from this article and it says, one of the more insidious aspects of social media's business model is the extent to which we, as social media users, replicate its logic at the level of our own activity. We perform market analysis of our own utterances, calculating the reaction a particular post will generate and adjusting our output accordingly. Negative emotions like outrage and contempt and anxiety tend to drive significantly more engagement than positive ones. End of quote. So I've talked before on this podcast as well about how you get to such a stage, and you know, I used to take these breaks, Belshaw Black Ops or whatever, and one of the things I really liked was thinking outside of tweets, because it got to the stage where I was using Twitter so much when it was, you know, 140 characters, that I knew instinctively how much 140 characters was, and it almost constrains your thinking. And so it was nice to take some time out to be able to think in bigger chunks. And Mastodon is 500 characters, and obviously your blog, you can write as much as you want. But I think that there's more than that now. It's not just the fact that you're, if you spend a lot of time on those services, that constrain your how much you've got. Like, it's not just that. It's constraining the kind of things that you want to share because of the reactions that you'll get, because you can instantly see how many likes you get, how many people clicked on it, all that kind of stuff.
I think that's a really interesting thing, isn't it? So one of the things that one of the digital leaders talked about in the video that we made in the last couple of days was seeking validity through your posts, and the idea that you post something on Instagram, it doesn't get enough likes, you take it back down. What a lot of people do, which is quite interesting, is they'll have their profile pictures and they'll switch them routinely. I've never done this, but they switch them, and when you switch it, the likes stay with that picture from when they were there before. When you switch back to it, if you know what I mean. So the likes, and then because it's new in the feed, people are liking it, digga, 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 and they haven't seen it in 6 months or whatever. So then the likes increase. And people kind of game it a bit like that, because it really does make them feel better somehow. I never get any great traction on anything I do. And so I just live in a world of I'm always interested in why I want to post something and that desire to share something. And I quite enjoyed using Mastodon because I can share a bit more freely, maybe.
Yeah, that's how I feel as well. The kind of responses you get are different from on Twitter. Maybe just as a different kind of demographic. Mm. But the article, that just to finish that off, the article in the New Yorker quotes James Bridle's book, The New Dark Age, which I've actually just started reading yesterday. And there's a particular bit. He's an amazingly good writer. He's the one where, can you remember, I think it was the start of this year or last year, there was that article about YouTube and how it was just an algorithm-driven cesspit of awful stuff for kids. Remember that one?
Yeah. I remember talking about that.
Yeah, so he's got this book. And so just this quote at the bottom, which I've quoted. So the New Yorker quotes it, and I'm quoting it from the New Yorker, and I'll no doubt come up to read it in the book soon. He says, "To be alive and online in our time is to feel at one incensed and stultified by the onrush of information, helpless against the rising tide of bad news and worse opinions. Nobody understands anything, not the global economy governed by the unknowable whims of algorithms, not our increasingly volatile and fragile political systems, not the implications of the impending climate catastrophe that forms the backdrop of it all. We have created a world that defies our capacity to understand it, though not, of course, the capacity of a small number of people to profit from it. Deleting your social media accounts might be a means of making it more bearable and even of maintaining your sanity. But one way or another, the world being what it is, we are going to have to learn to live in it." End of quote.
Well, yeah, I think that's the... for us, for you and I, it might be something that you've deleted your Twitter history arc or whatever, and I haven't done that to mine. But still, I find myself not really knowing what I am on Twitter, maybe, I think, possibly. And what I'm using it for in certain ways, which I don't really care about either. So I just find myself caring less about it. Maybe that's the deal. But whereas with that sentence might appeal to us, one of the things talking to our year nines today about their phones and social media and doing the things that the digital leaders was, I was thinking that for them, it's very, very different. For them, these are rivers that they're seeing for the first time, and they're curious about where they come from and how deep they are and whether they can swim in them or not, and that kind of thing. And it's that's sort of my job, really, is to help them understand that, I think, and to dip their toe in the water and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. They are going to have to learn to live in it, but they also want to learn to live in it. They see they see that as an exciting, non-mundane or non-ordinary part of life that they, you know, that they will possibly delve into, you know.
Yeah, and there's whole ways of being which are going to die out with our generation, because we are the last generation of people who can remember what it was like before the internet.
Yeah, I think that's a fair shout, absolutely. And then you look at, so I'm looking at Hugh Wells's response to when I talked about the PLN and where he's gone with his life and doing that, and how he found Twitter really helped him, which is not dissimilar to how it helped me or it helped you. And back in the day when you start finding people online and connecting with people who are thinking about the same things you're thinking, but have a different experience towards it. And it's all, you know, can be a really amazing tool for that. It's kind of cool.
You just reminded me of Howard Rheingold talking about attention. I'm just going to see if I can find a link here. I'm not going to be able to find it quickly. But
attention economy.
Net Smart, he talks about how attention is a literacy. So maybe I'll just put a link to his book. It's a few years old now, but the thing about it I really like is that he started from a human point of view, and the fact that we should approach all of this stuff from a human aspect, and how you should be tuning your feed and dropping people who or source information that you don't find useful, and amplifying other people, and doing some crap detection and stuff. So I'll put a link to NetSmart, the book, on his website there. I think he's all but retired now. He draws stuff and makes stuff on Patreon. He's not doing the kind of digital literacy work he was doing before.
Yeah, no, he's retired from university, isn't he?
Yeah. Literally, while you were talking there, and obviously I was paying attention to everything you were saying, Di.
Naturally.
Someone put on Mastodon a link to something called Manyverse. I don't know, have you seen, when you've been on Mastodon, people talking about something called Scuttlebutt?
No, I don't think I have.
Scuttlebutt is something, so when you go to Manyverse, so it's Manyverse with a dot before the S-E, Manyver.se. It's a beautiful website, and it exhorts you to download the app on Google Play. There's no iOS version yet. But Scuttlebutt is an off-the-grid social network designed for people who go on boats and stuff, so that you can, whenever you've got a signal, you can sync up your social network and stuff, but you can still be interacting and doing stuff and favoring and everything. It's all kind of, it works offline as well. And from what I understand, the people behind it have developed some amazingly resilient infrastructure for this, based on this thing called Scuttlebutt. And this particular app called Manyverse allows you to do it on mobile. Previously, I have used Scuttlebutt before, and they have this thing called Patchwork, but it was previously only available on the web or as an app on a desktop machine. So I'm actually quite excited, especially from a Mastodon point of view and protocols and open standards, to see this thing called Manyverse, because it, as soon as you get a mobile app for a social network, it changes the game.
It does. The link to their app on the Play Store, Google Play Store, did not exist.
Yeah, it works for me.
It doesn't work for me. Let me just switch browsers and see what happens.
And a couple of things about it, just while we're in passing, if you're interested. Manyverse is a social network mobile app with features you would expect: posts, threads, likes, profiles, etc. But it's not running in the cloud owned by a company. Instead, your friends' posts and all your data live entirely in your phone. This way, even when you're offline, you can scroll, read anything, and even write posts and like content. When your phone is back online, it syncs the latest updates directly with your friends' phones through a shared local Wi-Fi or on the internet. We're building this free and open source project as a community effort because we believe in non-commercial, neutral, and fair mobile communication for everyone. And it says it's forever free, no ads, no paywall, no data centers, no cloud, no cookies, no company, no investors, no token, no ICO, no blockchain, no tracking, no spying, no analytics, no tedious registration, no premium costs, no annoying notifications, emails, and banners.
Sounds like a dream right there. they are certainly identifying that whole thing, which is to get back to what's good about these things, which is connecting with people who are, you're interested in hearing about what's going on and what they're thinking about, what they're talking about. I think that's really important.
I'm always interested in how these things are funded, and it doesn't particularly tell you how Manyverse is funded. You go to their Open Collective page at the bottom of their website, and they've only just launched this, fair enough, but they're looking for 36,000 euros, which will let them hire one developer per year, And then like all the way up to seeding a non-profit for 150,000 euros a year. Currently, today's balance is $117 or euros.
Well, who are these people? Peter? Mm. Oh, these are people who are, no, these are hosts.
It looks like it literally launched yesterday, to be fair, but.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So sick. Thank you for this.
Mm. Anyway, moving on. I watched a video this week. Now, that might not sound amazing to you, Di, because you watch videos all the time.
I do.
I am not the kind of person who would sit down and watch a 30-minute video usually and just, you know, sit there and not do anything. But this one was by Cory Doctorow, who speaks quickly enough for me not to get frustrated by the lack of progress. And also, he was talking about something kind of close to my heart, which is big tech, monopolies, and decentralization. And it's the closing keynote from the Decentralized Web Summit last month. And it's not an easy way for me to sum it up, but he's kind of reinvigorated me when sometimes I think, oh, you know what? My life would be easier if I just used a MacBook and an iPhone and used all Google services and signed up to Facebook again. But actually, he talks about how, you know, what big tech has done, the problems, the monopolies, the lack of antitrust regulation, and how we can reclaim some of that. I really was quite inspired after listening, watching him speak.
Inspired to what, though? What are you going
to
do?
Well, inspired to keep on fighting the fight, like inspired to kind of like not capitulating to big tech's interests. And in fact, the next day, so September the 24th, 2 days ago, I came across this yesterday, in Bloomberg, there's an article entitled Tech Giants Spend $80 Billion to Make Sure No One Else Can Compete. And on a previous episode of Tide, we talked about how Google Maps has got this moat. Remember that thing? And how they're doing all of this stuff to make sure that no one can compete with them. And this particular one, in Bloomberg, is talking about how Google and Amazon and Facebook and Apple are spending billions and billions of dollars and really ramping it up recently to spend money on infrastructure so that nobody else can compete with them. Like nobody can serve videos faster. Nobody can, you know, do all of the things that need to happen to ensure that their monopoly stays. And the point that Cory Doctorow is making is that they're not just investing in infrastructure, they're also investing in legal, making it illegal basically to compete with them, hence Article 9 and 13 in the EU.
Yes, I think that's true. So we've talked about this before because they actually get together, don't they, these big tech companies, to organize how they're going to, you know, so really they're getting together under the guise of, I don't know, establishing standards or whatever protocol. But really what they're doing is they're just making it so that the barriers to entry for a smaller firm has become insurmountable. And I think that's interesting. One of the things, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I found out a few months ago that YouTube, so Google puts servers in all the major ISPs. So they have servers in there to deliver the YouTube content to make sure that the content can get out as fast as it can along the internet pipes. But just think about that. So there's going to be a crazy amount of money. But imagine that you and I run an ISP, and Google were set, and Google were giving us really expensive, fantastic free kit. Do you know what I mean? To help us.
Yeah, you'd say yes straight away. You know, in the world of football, billions and billions of pounds, dollars, euros, whatever, have been pumped into clubs, and it got so bad that there's now kind of FIFA regulations around being able to break even and balance the books. And like Paris Saint-Germain and Real Madrid and other people and Manchester City have fallen foul of this. It's a similar kind of situation with tech companies. Like Amazon has made a loss for years, like decades almost. YouTube, when that was bought by Google, they had to pump in billions before it could make a profit. And they're doing the same with infrastructure so that nobody can catch up. This Bloomberg article says the $80 billion tab is also a snapshot of why it's tough to unseat the tech giants. How can a company hope to compete with Google's driverless cars when it spends $20 billion a year to ensure it has the best laser-guided sensors and computer chips? There are a lot of physical assets behind all those internet clouds, end of quote.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's all true. And the way that you do make things, he said, sitting in the boarding house of an elite private school is to up the ante of the cash. And, you know, that does that. And we're working very hard at the moment as a school to reduce our fees, interestingly, because we want to make sure that we never... that they just don't keep going up and up and up. But it's still, that's a difficult thing to do. I don't know. Fight the good fight. But I mean, what are you supposed to do? It's an interesting thing, isn't it? You know, getting a job with Google. So I've met this, a gentleman's joined our staff called Neil Salvi. I've not looked him up online, actually. I'm going to do it right now. And he's joined as a math teacher. But he sold his company to Nvidia. So he's a Silicon Valley man. It's quite interesting. So he's an English man of Asian heritage, and he's been living in America. And this must be about him. I don't know. Anyway, and he's been 3 years out of Silicon Valley. And come to teach maths here. So it's been quite interesting. He's been asking me to look at these products that he's on the board or for, and it's called Gradarius, which teaches calculus. And we're having these conversations. And I thought he wanted to talk to me about bringing these products into the school, you know, and really just wants to talk about them, I think. But he was saying this. So in America, in Colorado last year, 107,000 degrees were awarded by universities in Colorado without the students ever stepping foot on a campus. So they're all done online, and 60% of those degrees included the students having to study calculus. Now in America, you don't study calculus until you get to university, whereas here we do it at A level, so it's a different setup. But also everybody, or the majority of people, have to study calculus at university in America, no matter what subject you actually are reading. So they have, you know, lecture halls with 300-500 people in, and you obviously can't teach calculus in that ratio. There's no sort of one-to-one time. So this tool is a bit sort of Wolfram Alpha Mathematica like, giving you instant feedback as you take the different steps, doing your differentiation or whatever it was you do in a crazy subject. Quite interesting. And that's where they're looking for the thing. And he's been charged with finding a market outside of America for it. And India is his first stop.
Why is that? Just because it's a large market and
Massive, because there aren't enough teachers, and there are lots and lots of people learning and trying to improve themselves. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what your experience is, but if you look at YouTube these days, because I obviously look for a lot of computer science stuff, and on there, a lot of it is done by Indian people. Mm-hmm. For Indian markets, so it's not.
Oh, I had an interesting on that note. I had an interesting experience today. So I was talking to Mayel and Alex on my team, and I was like, hey, and it'd be great if you could write some blog posts about what is that you're up to. And we were talking about whether that should be a separate blog or whether it should be on their own blogs or whatever. And we decided that the blog post should go on the main Moodle net blog, blog.moodle.net. But if it went on the main kind of home feed, it might put off if there were, you know, they didn't want to have to write like, technical post for a non-technical audience. But if you don't do that and it goes on the main page of a blog like MoodleNet, then it might put some people off. So what to do? So I decided I was going to have a look at different plugins and themes to solve this. Long story short, I managed to fix it by excluding a development category from the front feed and by putting a link at the top. But what I'd done is I'd asked on Twitter and on Mastodon, and I'd used the WordPress hashtag on Twitter, and oh my goodness, the number of replies I got, and then the number of DMs I got saying, oh hell, I can do that for you straight away. And it was all Indian people.
Wow, okay. And there you go, you see, people
are trying to... on it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're trying to make money out of so they're learning their skills, and so clearly that's people hunting the web for WordPress users, and so that they can go out and help them with their skill set. Interesting.
All right then. Where should we go next?
What is next? Let's just go there.
Well, there's one I'd quite like to talk about just quickly. I'll move that up. We haven't talked about this yet, have we? No, I haven't. Noah Giesel, who I know from the Open Badges community, he actually organized the Open Badge Summit every year. He wrote a great post on how to be an educational consultant. And basically, he said they get a few messages every month from people who like want to meet up for a coffee so they can pick his brain about becoming a consultant. They're currently teachers or whatever. And he wrote this post, and I kind of quote him in my Thought Shrapnel post and add in my own two cents, because I think that the grass, you know, for those who are listening to this, who are consultants, you know what it's like. And for those who haven't ever been self-employed and maybe are teachers or, you know, have a stable job where they're looking enviously at the grass being greener over there. It's a useful insight, I think, Noah's post into what exactly you can expect.
Okay, so I like this. The first thing you or Noah would do is to get underneath a desire to do something different. Why is that? Why would you want to do that? I think he does this brilliantly by asking whether potential consultants are running towards or running away from something. Mm-hmm. Quote, which way are you running? This is the most important question. Are you running to a new opportunity, or are you running away from your current situation? The people I know who are successful and happy doing this work definitely ran to it. The work is just too hard to be anything other than what you want or even need to be doing. I can't speak for others, but my own experience is that this path is a calling, not an escape pod. Sage advice.
Right, and I think that, you know, the way that I kind of glossed that was, you know, if no one's asking you already, if you can help them out with something that you specialize in, if you've got some expertise in something and you're recognized for that and people are asking for your help, then fair enough. But if you're going to have to leave a stable job to bootstrap a company or your own kind of consultancy, and you aren't known for anything in particular, that is going to be a hard road.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things, isn't it?
So when I left Mozilla, people were like queuing up to say, how do I implement open badges? How do I do this? Whatever. City and Guilds bought 6 months of my time right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, you need a big contract. I think, and that's how you did it. But it's never an easy road, and I think that's right. I can't speak for others, but it's a path. Path is a calling, not an escape pod. I think it's a great line.
I would probably call these something different, maybe organize them slightly differently. But he says that there's like basically four different types of consultancy you can do. But bear in mind, he's based in the US. He says, number one, you can join forces with a known legacy brand. Number two, you could apply for a posted position as a consultant. You could, number three, be an independent consultant, the hometown hero variety, he calls it. Or number four, you could be an independent consultant, the free agent variety. And to me, numbers one and two, you know, join forces with a known legacy brand and apply for a posted position, that's just getting a different job. That's just like being a salesperson or, you know, whatever within a company. The third one, the independent consultant hometown hero variety, well, if you do that, unless you lock people into multi-year contracts, you're going to run out of work pretty soon, because you're going to completely... you're going to have done work, all the work you possibly can in a given area. So really the only option you've got is the free agent variety. And that is like, you have to continually hustle for new work. And you also have to do it in such a way where you don't look desperate at any time. Because if you do, people can smell that and they don't want to have pity on you.
Yeah, no, it puts them off, doesn't it? I agree. I think that's absolutely right. And I think, I mean, I've watched different consultants sort of etch their means of income out and build their business in different ways. And it's really important to be incredibly focused and know what you are expert at and be employed for that reason, sort of thing, or be signed for a get contracts for that reason. But it just, it's always struck me as like too much like hard work.
No, it definitely is hard work. And I think the best thing that I've ever done is set up a co-op with kind of friends and former colleagues. It got to the stage at the end of last year where I didn't really want to continue doing my own consultancy. I wanted to work with the co-op. And it was effectively stick or twist, with the co-op being a part-time thing that we all do. And it, you know, there's no stress, no pressure. And we do it on top of the other things that we're doing. Or were we going to kind of go full bore and make it into our main thing? And I think that we all kind of looked at each other and decided, let's just keep it as our kind of side thing. So at that point, I decided that, you know, I was offered the position at Moodle, basically, and I said yes. I was offered a couple of other positions as well, which was nice. But the Moodle thing means that I can do as much or as little co-op work as I want, which is awesome.
Mm. Yes, yes. No, that's I mean, the gig is can you make enough money to sustain your lifestyle? I mean, that's the gig, isn't it?
Yeah, and the best way of doing that, I would say, a couple of things. First of all, think about what you actually need in life. This post that I'm writing at the moment, I touch on kind of just quickly on Maslow's hierarchy of needs and how actually a lot of the stuff that we say that we need in life isn't actually necessary for our survival. And what we do quite a lot of the time is do things for the sake of status. And if you can remove that desire for status in life, and just focus on what you and your family actually need, then you can reduce your costs massively, which obviously gives you much more of a runway if you do want to be a consultant. And the second thing is, don't just quit your job and then decide to be a consultant. Like, you need to, the best thing to do is to winnow down your days. I mean, go to 4 days, go to 3 days, whatever, and then try and build up your consultancy or whatever it is you want to do in the spare time. The other thing I'm going to say in this post is that volunteering is the best way of getting a network, because nobody's choosing to interact with you based on financial concerns, and you can get access to people and situations that otherwise you wouldn't get access to. So do all of that. And of course, to be able to survive on 3 days or four days of income means that either you need to be earning more money or you need to live beneath your means, which is an important thing to do in life, I think.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely.
Anyway, not sermon over. there we go. I'm going to skip the digital knowledge loop because I think that we can talk to that about that later on and maybe just put it in the show notes. But I did want to talk about something which is a bit more techie. If that one was more kind of touchy-feely consultancy stuff, this next one is very kind of techie. So this is all about IPFS, which we've talked about before.
What does IPFS mean, Doug?
IPFS stands for Interplanetary File System. IPFS is a way in which you can do decentralized serving of information. So it uses something a bit like BitTorrent, but it has redundancy. So let's say within a network, lots of people are sharing the same teaching resource or whatever. It will recognize that those two things are the same, put some version control on it, and also delete the ones which are just copies of the single example of it. And it's a decentralized system. An IPFS is great, but you can't access an IPFS network over the normal web, normal HTTP. So you need a portal. You need some kind of like jumping off point from the regular web into the distributed web or the D web. And Cloudflare, who people listening to this podcast might have come across before, because when you go to a website that is currently experiencing problems, it'll serve up a snapshot of that page. So lots of websites use it as a content delivery system or CDM. Cloudflare have announced that they're going to provide a gateway to the decentralized web using IPFS over HTTP, which is very exciting and something which will massively help the adoption of IPFS solutions to problems that we have, like MoodleNet, for example, which is all about sharing resources, and you don't want system administrators having to host like a bajillion versions of stuff. So have a look. We don't necessarily have to go through it now, Dai, but it's something worth looking at if you're interested in what's coming next.
Mm. Click here to go to an example. No examples. So that's doing that.
And while we're talking about like quite techy things, there's an incredible website and related kind of paper, which have we talked about this? I feel like I've talked about this with you or someone else.
Which one?
It's the Amazon one. The Amazon Echo as an anatomical map of human labor, data, and planetary resources.
I don't think I've talked about that with anyone.
Well, what they do is this particular website. So if you go to the Anatomy of AI website, it's just anatomyof.ai. It's got this amazing diagram of what happens when you say, like, Alexa or whatever, do this. And of course, we just experience Alexa responding to us almost instantly. But there's all of this stuff happening, and it kind of maps out what's happening from a human labor perspective, what's happening with data, what's happening in terms of the impact on planetary resources when that happens.
I think I read this on Thor Strapnell. Yes, so this is the actual the hidden costs, if you like, of processes that are going on for us to receive. I think this is something that I've been thinking about over the summer in America, actually. In the idea that for us to do a little thing, for example, take an aeroplane flight, drive a car down the road, all of the processes that stack underneath that to enable that to happen. And of course, there are economies of scale going on in big style, but there are lots and lots of things that are really quite damaging to the world going on, and yet not, because there are also things that provide people with money and employment and resources to live on. So, you know, that's the network, the web of society, if you like. And as you said before, with a web page or a web source, as was it Ros John, whatever his name was, in the book, you can't stand one node of the web without looking at all of the nodes of the web. Sort of thing. It's never simple.
I think it's worth reading through the first couple of quotations that I've just picked out from the whole thing, which is definitely worth a read. I just read it, actually. I think I read it on a train platform on my phone. Like, it's quite long, but it's definitely readable on a mobile device. I'll read the first one, and you can read the second one if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, with each interaction, Alexa is training to hear better, to interpret more precisely, to trigger actions that map to the user's command more accurately, and to build a more complete model of their preferences, habits, and desires. What is required to make this possible? Put simply, each small moment of convenience, be it answering a question, turning on a light, or playing a song, requires a vast planetary network fueled by the extraction of non-renewable materials, labor, and data. The scale of resources required is many magnitudes greater than the energy and labor it would take to take a human to operate a household appliance or flick a switch. A full accounting of these costs is almost impossible, but it is increasingly important that we grasp the scale and scope if we are to understand and govern the technical infrastructures that thread through our lives. End of quote. So my wife and I, given that she's at home all the time at the moment and I work from home, we do the crossword together at lunchtime every day. And when we get to the end of the crossword and I need to get back to work, we do the last ones by looking them up, or if we're particularly stuck on one. And the way that I do that is that I use the Google Assistant to do that these days. But of course, using the Google Assistant is exactly what this is talking about. It's extremely convenient for me not to have to type things in. But it's kind of all of this unseen world, the bottom of the iceberg, whatever, that we don't see hidden behind the very useful digital assistant.
That's true, but let's take this out, okay? So he says flicking a light switch. So let's just think a little bit about how you arrive at a light switch on the wall in a house. And you know, that has its own under the water iceberg footprint as well, for want of a better word, kind of thing of not necessarily so many quite scarce resources, but certainly of thing, you know, processes that aren't doing the world any good. Right. Running electricity through the country, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so it's not as simple as he's making out, but it is, there's definitely more going on with you asking Alexa than there is with you just using your phone to search the internet. Than there is, getting a book maybe and looking it up in an encyclopedia or a thesaurus or some sort. Possibly.
I think the point is that it's invisible. I think this map does a great job of, it's included at the top of that Thought Shrapnel post. It's quite zoomed out. I mean, it's worth getting the PDF and things so you can zoom into it a bit. But it kind of just raises some questions, I think, about some of the assumptions that we make.
Okay, so here's the next extract. When a human engages with an Echo or another voice-enabled AI device, they are acting as much more than just an end product consumer. It is difficult to place the human user of an AI system into a single category. Rather, they deserve to be considered as a hybrid case, just as the Greek chimera was a mythological animal that was part lion, goat, snake, and monster. The Echo user is simultaneously a consumer, a resource, a worker, and a product. This multiple identity recurs from human users in many technological systems. In the specific case of the Amazon Echo, the user has purchased a consumer device for which they receive a set of convenient affordances, but they are also a resource, as their voice commands are collected, analyzed, and retained for purposes of building an ever larger corpus of human voices and instructions, and they provide labor as they continually perform the valuable service of contributing feedback mechanisms regarding the accuracy, usefulness, and overall quality of Alexa's replies. They are, in essence, helping to train the neural networks within Amazon's infrastructural stack.
Well read. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of those ones. I think this would be a fantastic one to use with teenagers to make, you know, some of the language is perhaps difficult, maybe A level, but just make them think about what's going on there.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
So last week, Amazon did I haven't got a quick link to this, but Amazon did their new reveal of what they're producing next in terms of smart home stuff.
And something like 72 different devices they unveiled, I think. Is that right?
How many do you say?
72.
Wow.
Crazy number.
So lots of things, and they're really doubling down on the kind of smart home stuff, which is great. Yeah, fantastic. But where was I going with that? One of the things that they said is a feature now of Alexa is that you're going to be able to switch your lights on and off even if there's no internet connection. Now, how long have we had Alexa, and how long has it taken them to think outside of the Silicon Valley bubble that sometimes people's internet connections go down? And I think that some of this stuff, we assume that it's happening on a local level, but our internet connection speeds are so fast these days that actually a lot of these queries are maybe in a hybrid sense, but certainly going outside of the network to get what's needed. And that obviously has an impact on a global level.
Yeah, no, massive. Yeah, absolutely. Of course it does. It's crazy. I don't know. I was looking at the other day. I always, when I'm in class, I always say that computers do 3 billion things a second, right? Just, you know, I just picked about 3 gigahertz processor, whatever. And and then I always think, no one's going to believe you. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I was reading about the WWDC, so Apple's conference recently, and just what they, you know, just looking at the headlines of what they brought out. And then someone was saying the processor they brought out, it's possibly in their new watch, but it might be in probably one of their new whatevers. But it can do 5 trillion processors a second. I was just like, what? We're getting further and further away. I mean, 3 billion obviously already is abstract and crazy, but 5 trillion, I was just like, oh, okay. Well. Do you know what I mean? So I was.
One thing we haven't talked about, actually, I know this is perhaps taking us away from the education side of stuff, but I don't know if I can find the article. I think it was Zenny Jardine who writes for Boing Boing. And there was a great, let me see if I can find it quickly. Did you see that, you mentioned Apple and WWDC, did you see that the Apple Watch 4 has ECG built in?
I did see that.
Right. So I'm just going to get the link here. I'm going to stick the link into the show notes and clean up in a moment. Basically, Zenny Jardine links to something that she wrote on Boing Boing, and her tweet summary was, Apple launches a new watch that tracks heart data, runs EKGs, promises to save lives. 1 week later, one of America's biggest health insurers kills traditional life insurance, launches interactive policies that use health data from wearable tracker devices.
Oh, you're joking. Fantastic. Which is just, I mean, this is just social credit by a whole new thing, isn't it?
And absolutely. It's like, absolutely. So I might have mentioned this on Tide. I can't remember because it's been a few weeks what I've said and what I haven't. I was I was waiting for my haircut the other day, and someone walked in and saw obviously an acquaintance, and they were looking for things to say to each other. And one of them said about a mutual acquaintance that they were off the road. They weren't driving anymore. And when the other person asked, like, what had happened, had they been banned, was it drink driving, whatever, they said, no, they were caught by the black box inside their car that the insurer puts in, Aviva, going 75 in a 60-mile-an-hour zone, and Aviva cancelled their insurance.
Really? Yeah. You see, that's going to happen more and more and more. So the black box has come in. So to get teenagers in... So one of my students had to have a black box in their car all the time, so that whenever he drove the car, it would monitor his driving. It was quite funny. And he was always very proud that his driving was so much better than his parents, because he would take corners. You know, he knew how to drive the car better, as young people like to think in that way. but that is the future. I mean, so we're talking about social credit in China, scary, scary, boom, boom. And then really that sort of thing is going on in everywhere in its own way. You know, it's just different ways for different cultures, I guess.
Well, it starts off a bit like the social credit stuff, all this kind of stuff as you know, oh, just a bit of fun and like, oh, look, they're using technology and whatever. And it mentions in this blog post on Boing Boing, I'll link to the tweet because it's a good summary, but in the tweet is linked to the Boing Boing article. So the insurer is called John Hancock, and they're the ones who have brought in the use of wearable devices such as Fitbit and Apple Watch and whatever. And they've got this Vitality program. Well, the Vitality program was actually used by some UK insurers, including Prudential. And I actually had, for a very short period of time, private health insurance when I lived in Doncaster. And that was because on Money Saving Expert, that wonderful website, it told you a way in which you can game the system to get free gym membership. Basically, if you joined up for this private health insurance and went to the gym often enough, and literally all you had to do was swipe in, you didn't have to go to actually do any exercise, just swipe in, then you got enough points to get your gym membership effectively for like £3 or £2 a month. So that's what I used to do. But this is like, you know, now a decade later, it's now stuff's on our wrists, monitoring our stuff all the time. Insurers in the US and other countries have access to that data. They promise lower premiums, but eventually they'll just pull all the rest of the programs like John Hancock have done that and force people into using this data. And some people, I guess, they'll just refuse to insure.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what will happen. As long as they can make their money, that's what they're interested in. And the way that they make their money is by keeping their premiums up but reducing the number of payments that they have to make, obviously. So anything that's going to push people towards that direction. I had my Fitbit over the summer. Remember I said I was wearing a Fitbit that I'd taken off my dad And somehow when I was in America, I managed to break it. But before that, I was monitoring the data. And I really did put it through its paces in America because I was, you know, in rivers all of the time and, you know, all that sort of thing. I found the data to be really annoying. I don't care what my heart rate's at unless I need to care. Do you know what I mean? But my heart rate's okay. I'm kind of quite fit. I'm quite active. I have sedentary days where I don't do much, but I kind of know that I've done that. I kind of know, you know, I smoke, I shouldn't, sort of thing. You know, I know when I do things that are bad for me and I know when I'm living healthily and well. I don't need a monitor to tell me that this stuff is going okay.
And this is the thing about smart devices and smart homes in general. Like, it gives such a small, marginal, incremental improvement to your life. The fact that you can say, you know,
I've improved this. I've done 12,000 steps.
I was thinking about the crossword clue. Like, you can speak the crossword clue instead of typing it in, or you know what your heart rate is at any given time, or the lights change color when you get an email, or whatever it is. Such a small incremental improvement to your life. Yet the data exhaust from that is immensely valuable to people. My watch, which is actually made by Xiaomi, so my data is going to China, I guess. Awesome. It has an interesting approach to battery life in that it monitors your heart rate at particular times. So when it notices you've been still for a while, it monitors your heart rate to see if you're asleep, and then it'll turn into sleep mode.
All right. Okay. I don't know. All of this stuff's a bit, I have to say, having notifications on my wrist was interesting a little bit. But only that was sort of quite interesting. But I turned off all the notifications about you haven't done this or yippee, you've done that and blah, 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 blah. But telling me stuff about what I'd done with my day. I didn't care. I don't know. I just thought I'm going to be okay. The cigarette's going to kill me before, you know, being 3,000 steps short of 10,000 today, I think.
It's quite a kind of... it's like a nanny state. It's quite patriarchal, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's what but the thing I really didn't like is that I found myself wanting to meet targets and wanting to be driven by what somebody else had decided was good. And I know I could set it, the targets, to be what I want them to be and all of that. But it was just that idea of monitoring. I just didn't need that data in my life, basically.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, Di, I have done the grand total, given that I haven't felt very great today. I've done no exercise and I've done 1,955 steps.
That's a beautiful day right there.
Yeah.
Right there. I hope you enjoyed it and I hope you celebrate it and I hope your watch buzzes at you and goes, whoopee, well done.
Absolutely. I'm celebrating with a whiskey, so there we go.
So I don't know. Anyway, I wasn't really impressed with that. Excellent. Sorry, I've just seen this thing down on Boing Boing. It says, Internet of Shit Watch. No idea what it's about.
I don't know if you subscribe to Boing Boing. It's Cory Doctorow found it with Zenny Jardine and some other people ages and ages ago. It's such a fantastic website.
I think I will. That's phenomenal.
I wanted to ask you about something else that you put on Mastodon, was your new approach to making sure that you read stuff that you've bookmarked.
All right, okay. He's right. So I have this problem because I come across articles and I read, generally speaking, I read a lot of things in the morning when I'm waking up and having my coffee and whatever. So I'll read newspapers and I'll check all my feeds on this, that, and the other, and see if there's anything interesting to entertain the day. And sometimes I come across really interesting articles that I like. And I look at the article and I think, I've got 3 lessons to plan before work starts. So I get up quite early. So this is, you know, quite a chunk of time, but I've got to like plan my lessons and I've got to get washed and dressed and to my classroom. Anyway, I want a way, or I've never found a satisfactory way of storing things that I think I'd really like to read that properly in detail. and I don't have the time to do it now. So I start reading the first couple of paragraphs and you're kind of into it and you think, I'll just share it. And you haven't actually, you know, I hate doing that. You feel like such a dick when you share something that you've not actually completely read and consumed. And anyway, so then I just started, I just thought, I'll send it to myself. When I went to the share thing, it said home screen. So I've been reducing, I just have a black blank home screen. I don't have any pictures on it. But on the front page of my home screen, I have my home screen with folders at the bottom, which contain all of the apps that I want to use, a search app, and I have a Trello card adder on there. So if there's something that comes into my life, I have that, and then it goes into my Trello thing, and I'll farm it out to wherever it needs to go. But the articles I don't do that with, which I probably could, to be fair. Anyway. I just started adding the actual web page to the home screen. So it just sits there on the top of the home screen with no other icons, just by themselves. And they're there for me to read later. So then I'll read them. When I process them, I'll share them or just delete them and not worry about it. And I just thought that was what it did is it took out that sort of a step out of the process, which is going and putting something somewhere that I'm going to go and read later. It just kept that article in the thing, like, go and read the article. Have you got that 20 minutes right now? Yes, you have. Okay. Go and read that article now and get it out of the way with. And it's so far, it's working really well for me. I'm liking it.
Oh, cool. I'm always interested in the approach that people have. I noticed they're using Opera, the web browser.
Yes. So I routinely change browsers. So I have 6 installed, I think. So I have 2 Firefoxes, so no, 5. 2 Firefoxes, Opera, Brave, something else.
On your phone, this is?
And Chrome, yeah. Wow. Yeah, so the default one is Opera at the moment. And so I use the default one as Opera, and then if I use DuckDuckGo, which is a browser as well, as my search engine, which when you press it opens up as a browser, and I think. And... yeah, so that's that. That's what I do. And because I'm curious about Opera. I'm curious, you know, how good they are, how well they're coding their site. I know that Mozilla they released Quantum quite a while ago, but they just sort of upped its ante, I think. I saw some publicity not too long ago. So I'm back into Mozilla again. And I've been stuck back into Chrome because you always end up defaulting back to Chrome. And I do like Chrome in some ways, but not in others. Just because I want to be in different environments, different tech corps, because they can't all have my thing. I've also gone with a new VPN recently.
Which one's that?
Called, it's a paid for one called Private Internet Access.
Okay. That makes it sound like porn, but okay.
Yeah, but it's not. It's just a VPN, dude. So that's quite nice. And I'm putting that on my different devices. And I don't like the way it runs on my phone. It seems to, whenever I switch Wi-Fi networks, it switches off and disconnects and doesn't automatically reconnect.
Well, can I highly recommend, again, Proton VPN, which is great.
No, I've looked at Proton before, but I had the same issue with that as well. It kept switching itself off on the mobile.
Really?
I jump between SSIDs enormously because I'm in a school.
Oh, okay.
So the boarding house has one set of SSIDs. So the way I tend to do that is I just jump between 4G and my home Wi-Fi, and that's that. But the PIA one looks really good, to be honest.
Oh, well, a couple of things. While we're talking about browsers, let me just say that Google announced that in Chrome 69, I think it was, or someone found out this was going to be the case. You know how you can be logged into, for example, Gmail without being logged in? Let's say you're in Chrome and you're in Gmail. You can be logged into Gmail without being logged into your Google account in the browser. Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, and I can see where Google will go on this, to be fair. It is confusing. And so they said with Chrome 69, people would, if they logged into, for example, Gmail or Google Calendar or something, when they're in Chrome, it would automatically log them into the browser. And people are like, oh my goodness, privacy nightmare. And look, when you clear your cookies, it doesn't clear the ones for Google and Chrome and stuff. Whereas actually what I did was delete that cookie and then it immediately made a new one so that you were never logged out, but actually it deleted all that. So I can see why Google would do this because it is very confusing. But I can also see why it was potentially a privacy nightmare. So today they announced that they're going to go back on that to the extent that you'll be able to opt out of it. But the default will be opting in, which means that if anybody who hasn't heard about this or doesn't know what's going on, if they log into a Google service in Chrome, it will be logging them into Google Chrome, the browser.
Yeah, which means basically stop using Chrome if you use Google services.
He says using Chrome OS as we speak.
Do you use inbox.google.com?
I do, and they're getting rid of that, aren't they?
Yeah, they're deprecating Inbox, going back to Gmail. And it's just a real shame. I like Inbox and don't like Gmail. So,
while we're talking about tech stuff, did I say we got rid of our home phone?
No, you didn't say that.
Right, well, we were, you know, the bill comes through, it's like an extra 20 quid a month on top of line rental and broadband and stuff to pay for unlimited calls so that my wife can phone her sister whenever she wants. And I did question this and say, why are we doing this when we've all, you know, we've both got smartphones, etc. And so we got rid of it and it got turned off while we were on holiday in August. And so we spent about a month since we got back without a phone, a home phone. And we turned around to each other and just said, you know what? I quite miss having a home phone.
Really? So
I looked at Andrews and Arnold, and who are my ISP, yeah. And they do a really easy to use voice over IP connection. And I could even choose my phone number. So that arrived today. It was already configured. They provide the equipment. I got a voice over IP phone that does loads of cool stuff. And I got to choose my number. So my home phone number is only 3 digits different from my previous number, which is awesome and easy to remember. And now it's pennies to per month to run that. And I feel like I'm living in the future.
Wow. Okay. I don't have a home phone. So maybe I'm further in the future than you are. I don't know.
Well, maybe. I lived in the further in the future for a month.
Yep. But we use WAP system at school. I think it's ShoreTel we use, and they are working on producing an app that goes on your mobile phone that will redirect your calls onto your mobile phone.
Well, this is what you can do with Andrews and Arnold. You can actually have a SIM which creates a virtual network so that you're actually using your voice over IP connection but on your mobile phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is awesome. All right, I'm going to suggest that we leave it there. The last two don't really flow on very well from what we're talking about. I'll stick them in the show notes in case people are interested in. Basically, audiobooks versus reading and the digital knowledge loop if people are interested.
Okay. Cool. What are you up to this week?
Well, it's 10 past 10 on Wednesday the 26th of September. Tomorrow morning, I'll be getting up early and I will be dosing myself up again on paracetamol and stuff and heading off to the Lake District to climb a couple of mountains. I think I've mentioned this before, but the Ordnance Survey has this amazing 3D mapping feature now. So I plot my route on a physical map, on a paper map to see what I'm going to do, and I try and understand it and all the different land features and stuff. Then I plot it in the Ordnance Survey app, which I've got on my phone, and then I can go onto my desktop machine, logged into my account, and I can do a flyby. And I can see what it's actually going to be like. There's a 7-day free trial for this as well at ordnancesurvey.com. I sound like an advert, but it is fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's really good because we go on DV and we're not allowed to use it. Really? Well, we are, but they're not. The children aren't, obviously, because they're on expedition. They have to use maps and compasses. Because they're hardcore.
So I'm doing that Thursday, Friday, staying at Ambleside Youth Hostel, which is incredibly cheap and awesome. And then next week, it's just a normal day, 4 days. Thursday, working on MoodleNet. My technical architect, Mael, is heading off on holiday for a few weeks. So it'll be all hands to the pump to make sure everything's documented before he goes, I guess.
Cool. Okay, well, we have a new day house at the school for young children aged 11 to 13. And that's being opened on Friday. Scott House, and there's going to be a celebrities coming to open it, but no one's allowed to know who, and I'm filming them and I don't know who it is. So I'm going to be doing that before we next speak, as well as the usual bump of teaching.
Cool. All right, then. Well, thank you very much for listening to this right to the end, if indeed you did. And until next time, which may be next week or maybe in 3 weeks, that has been Tide 109, coming from our respective homes.
It has indeed. Goodbye, everybody.
Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.